He estimated its height at 60,000 or 70,000 feet, way above the Lear's ceiling.
"How do you like that, Charlie Bravo?" he asked.
And Gary shook his head and looked down at the screen of the weather radar set. The enormous tropical thunderstorm showed up as a lurid and ferocious crimson cancer on the screen.
96 miles ahead, and it's a real Lulu. Looks like it's sitting right over one of our target river mouths, the Chikumba.
If it is, it will wipe out any signal from Bella's transponder. Sharza was looking worried.
We won't be able to fly through that anyway, Gary growled.
Overhead, the Katanka, Len. Are you picking up anything from our target?
A negative, Mr. Courtney.
And then his voice changed.
Oh, hold on. Oh, shit. Somebody's hitting us with a radar lash. Gary?
Sharza reached across to shake his shoulder. They've picked us up on radar.
Switch to the international frequency, Gary said, and listen.
They sat frozen in their seats, listening to the static of that great turbulent storm ahead.
Suddenly the carrier band hissed, and a voice cut in clearly.
Unidentified aircraft, this is Luanda Control. You are in restricted airspace. Identify yourself immediately. I say again, you are in restricted airspace.
Luanda Control, this is British Airways, flight BA-051. We have an engine malfunction. Request a position fix.
Sharza began a garbled, delaying argument with Luanda. Every second he could gain was crucial. He asked them for a clearance to land at Luanda and pretended not to be receiving or understanding their refusals and urgent orders to vacate national airspace.
They haven't fallen for it, Mr. Courtney,
Len warned him as he swept the military frequencies.
They've scrambled a flight of MiGs from Surima Airfield. They're vectoring them in on us.
How long before we cross the Chikumba River mouth? Gary demanded.
14 minutes, Sharza snapped back.
Well, lordy, lordy, Gary grinned. We are on a head-on course with those MiGs. They are coming in at Mach 2. This is going to be fun.
They sped southwards in the silver moonlight.
Mr. Courtney, we've got more radar lash. I think the MiGs have got us on their attack radar.
Thank you, Len. Chikumba River in 1:30.
Mr. Courtney,
there was a strident tone to Len's voice.
The MiG leader is reporting target acquisition. They're onto us, sir. The attack radar lash is increasing. The MiG leader is requesting weapons free.
I thought you said they couldn't intercept us, Sharza asked Gary mildly. I thought we were out of their operational range.
Hell, Dad, anyone can make a mistake.
Mr. Courtney, Len's voice was a shriek, I have the target signal, weak and intermittent, about 6 kilometers, dead ahead.
Are you sure, Len?
It's our transponder for sure.
The Chikumba River mouth.
Bella is at the Chikumba River,
Sharza shouted.
Let's get the hell out of here.
Mr. Courtney, the MiGs are weapons-free and attacking. Radar lash is very strong and increasing.
Hold on, Gary called. Grab your hats.
He rolled the Lear wing over into a dive.
What the hell are you doing?
Sharza shouted as he was pressed back into the co-pilot's seat by the G-Force.
Turn and get out to sea.
Ah, they'd nail us before we'd gone a mile.
Gary held the Lear in the dive.
Christ, Gary, you'll tear the wings off us.
The airspeed indicator revolved swiftly up towards the never-exceed barrier.
Take your choice, Pater. We tear the wings off her, or the MiGs shoot the arse off us.
Mr. Courtney, the MiG leader reports a missile lock.
Len was stuttering with terror.
What are you going to do, Gary?
Sharza grabbed Gary's arm.
I'm going in there.
Gary pointed at the soaring, moon-washed mountain of the thunderstorm. It was a sheer precipice of turbulent cloud that obscured the heavens ahead of them. The cloud banks boiled and seethed with the great winds and air currents within. Lightning flashed and glowed deep in the belly of the storm.
You're crazy,
Sharza whispered.
No MiG will follow us in, Gary said. No missile will hold its lock with all that energy and electrical discharge burning around us.
Mr. Courtney, the MiG leader has fired a missile, and another. 2 missiles running.
Pray for us sinners, Gary said, and held the Lear down in its death dive.
The airspeed needle went through the never-exceed barrier.
I think this is it,
Sharza's voice was matter-of-fact. And as he said it, something struck the Lear a crashing blow. She flipped over onto her back. The ball of the flight director spun like a top in its cage, and then they were into the storm. All visibility was wiped out instantly, and thick grey cloud like wet cotton wool engulfed them. They were thrown onto their safety harnesses as the storm attacked the Lear. It was a ravening beast that clawed and lashed them. The Lear tumbled and swirled like a dead leaf in a whirlwind. The instruments on the control panel spun and toppled. The altimeter yo-yoed as they dropped into the void and then hit a vicious updraft that hurled them up 2,000 feet and twisted them wing over wing. Suddenly the cloud was lit by internal lightning. It dazzled them and rumbled through their heads, drowning out the agonized shriek of the Lear's jets. Blue fire danced on the metal skin of the aircraft as though she were aflame. They hit the bottom of another hole with a force that plunged them against the padding of their seats and buckled their spines. Then they were hurled aloft, only to plunge once again. All around them the bodywork of the Lear creaked and groaned as the storm tried to rip her apart. Garry was helpless. He knew better than to fight the wheel and rudders and increase the brutal stress on her control surfaces. The Lear was fighting for her life. He whispered encouragement to her and held the control wheel with a light and loving touch, trying to ease her nose up out of the graveyard spiral. Courage, darling, he whispered. Come on, baby, you can do it. Sharza was clinging to the armrests of his seat and staring at the altimeter. They were down to 15,000 feet and still dropping. None of the other instruments were making any sense at all. They jerked and wavered and kicked. He concentrated on the altimeter. It unwound jerkily. 10,000, 7, 4,000. The strength of the storm increased. Their heads were whipped back and forth, threatening to snap their spines. Their shoulder straps cut painfully into their flesh. Something broke in the fuselage with a tearing crash. Sharza ignored it and tried to focus on the altimeter. His vision was starred and disoriented by the Lear's vicious plunges. 2,000 feet, 1,000, zero. They should have hit the ground. But the tremendous changes of barometric pressure within the swirling body of the storm had thrown out the reading. Suddenly the Lear steadied. The turbulence abated. Garry pressed on rudder and stick, and she responded. The flight director stabilized and rotated towards the vertical as the Lear rolled back onto an even keel, and they burst out of the cloud. The change was stunning. The noise of the storm gave way to the low hum of the jets. Moonlight flooded into the cockpit, and Sharza gasped with shock. They were almost upon the surface of the sea, skimming over it like a flying fish rather than a bird. A drop of another 100 feet would have plunged them beneath the green Atlantic rollers. "Cutting it a little fine, son," Sharza's voice was hoarse, and he tried to grin. But his eye patch had been shaken loose and hung down under his ear. He adjusted it with fingers that trembled. "Come on, navigator," Garry chuckled unconvincingly. "Give me a course to fly." New course is 260 degrees. How's she handling? Like a breeze. Garry turned gently on the new heading. The Lear came round serenely and sped out into the Atlantic, leaving the dark continental mass astern. Len? Sharza turned in the seat and looked back into the cabin. The technicians' faces were pale and washed lightly with the sweat of terror. What do you make of the MiGs? Len stared at him like an owl as he tried to adjust to the shock of still being alive. "'I'll pull yourself together, man,' Sharza snapped at him, and Len stooped quickly to his control panel. "'Yes, we still have contact. MiG leader is reporting target destroyed. He's short of fuel and returning to base.' "'Farewell, Fidel. Thank the Lord that you're a lousy shot,' Garry murmured, and kept the Lear low down on the surface clutter, where the shore radar would have difficulty picking them up. "'Where is Lancer?' "'Should be dead ahead.' Sharza thumbed the microphone. "'Donald Duck, this is the Magic Dragon. "'Go ahead, Dragon. "'It's the Chikumba. I repeat, it's the Chikumba. "'Do you copy that? Over. "'Roger, Chikumba. I say again, Chikumba. "'Did you have any trouble? "'We heard pom-pom jet traffic southeast of here. Over. "'Oh, nothing to it. It was a Sunday school picnic. "'Now it's your turn to visit Disneyland. Over. "'We're on our way, Dragon. Break a leg, Duck. Over and out.' It was 5:30 on Tuesday morning when Garry put the Lear down on the tarmac at Vintook Airport. They climbed down stiffly and stood in a group at the foot of the steps, overcome by a sense of anticlimax. Then Garry walked to the nearest engine, which was softly crackling and pinking as it cooled. "Peter," he called, "come and have a look at this." Sharza stared at the alien object that had buried itself in the metal fuselage below the pod of the Garrett turbofan engine.
It was painted a harsh industrial yellow. A long-finned arrow-like tube that protruded 6 feet from the torn metal skin of the Lear.
"What the hell is that?" Sharza asked.
"That, Mr. Courtney," said Len, who had come up behind him, "that is a Soviet Atoll air-to-air missile that failed to explode."
"Well, Gary," Sharza murmured, "Fidel wasn't such a lousy shot after all."
"Bless Russian workmanship," Gary said. "Perhaps it's a little early, Dad, but could you stand a glass of champagne?"
"What a splendid idea," said Sharza.
The Chikamba River. Shoulder to shoulder, Sean and Esau Gondele leant over the chart table. "There she is." Sean laid his finger on the tiny, insignificant nick in the outline of the continent. "Just south of Katakana." He looked up at the trawler skipper. Van der Berg was built like a sumo wrestler, squat and heavy, with a leathery skin burnt and desiccated by sun and wind. "What do you know about it, Van?" he asked. "I've never been in that close," Van shrugged. "Just another piss-willy little river, but I'll get you as close as you want to go. A mile off the reef will do us very nicely." "You got it," Van promised. "When?" "I want you to keep below the horizon all of tomorrow. Then at nightfall you can take us in at 0200 hours. For the scouts, the witching hour was always 2 hours after midnight. It was then that the enemy would be at his lowest ebb, both physically and mentally. At 1 o'clock in the morning, Sean held his final briefing in the crew mess of Lancer. He checked each man separately. They were all dressed in navy blue fishermen's jerseys and jeans and black canvas rubber-soled combat boots. On their heads were knitted black woolen caps, and all their faces and hands were black, either naturally or with camo cream. The only uniform items they wore were their webbing, all of it supplied by the South African Defence Force from Cuban equipment captured in the south of Angola. Their weapons were Soviet AKM assault rifles, Tokarev pistols and Bulgarian M-75 anti-personnel grenades. Three men in Esau Gondele's section would carry RPG-7 anti-tank rocket launchers. Part of the agreement with the South Africans for their cooperation was that nothing would ever be traced back to them. One at a time, they stepped up to the table and handed over all their personal items, signet rings, dog tags and paybooks, wallets and wristwatches, and any other form of identification. Esau Gondele sealed them in separate envelopes and issued each of them with an identical black waterproof digital wristwatch to replace their own. While this was happening, the trawler captain called on the intercom from the bridge. "We're 7 nautical miles off the river mouth. Bottom is shoaling nice and gently. I'll have you in position a few minutes before time." "Good on you," Sean told him, and then turned back to the ring of black faces. "Very well, gentlemen, you know what we're after. Just a few airy thoughts to occupy those busy little minds of yours. If you're going to cull anybody, just make sure that you don't take out the woman or the child. She's my sister." He let that sink in for a moment. "Thought number two. The sketch maps I've shown you are more fantasy than fact. Don't rely on them. Thought number three. Don't get left behind on the beach when we pull out. Chikamba is no place to spend a holiday. The food and the accommodation are rotten." He picked up his rifle from the bunk. "So, my children, let's go and do it." Lancer groped towards the shore with radar and depth sounder. All her running lights were extinguished. Her engines were ticking over, so she barely maintained steerage. In the darkness ahead, Sean could make out the intermittent luminous flare of the surf breaking on the outer reef. There were no lights ashore. The land itself had been absorbed by the night. The cloud overhead was unbroken. No glimmer of star or moon came through. Van der Berg straightened up from the radar hood. 1 mile off, he said quietly. Water is 6 fathoms and shoaling. He glanced across at the dark figure of his coloured helmsman. Stop engines. The tremble of the engines through the deck beneath their feet ceased, and Lancer wallowed like a log. Thanks, Van, Sean said. I'll bring you back a nice present. He ran lightly down the companionway to the main deck.